Accession number 28657, Mr. Jeff King, Reel 3. We're talking about your time at number one Air Armament School at Manby from September 1940 onwards. We're just sort of looking at some of the jobs you did on the Wellington in particular. Now, after a while, you moved from looking after a engine, a Pegasus, to
yes.
move to this separate job.
That's right.
Of fitting out. Go through what the difference was. What were you doing this time? You had a specialist role on the engines.
That's right. I had then gained my leading air craftsman's badge.
Did the promotion make much difference?
Just a few pence, from a pay point of view. And you got that little bit more responsibility. This, as far as I was concerned, meant, in my own case, if an aircraft needed any adjustment or a change of air screw, which was a very rare occasion, I would do this. I'd also work on magnetos and carburettors. And likewise, I had a friend, a very good friend, that, like myself, was doing this job. And I became very friendly with him. And I used to go up to Grimsby with him at weekends.
Hang on. Now, I'll come back to him. How would you change an air screw? Is that a big job? I mean, I know you don't...
Yes, yeah.
How do you do it?
One had to move the aircraft into the hangar, of course. And you had not a mobile crane, but it was the aircraft was usually positioned in a certain position in the hangar where you had pulleys above you, and one had to fix rope supports around the air screw, loosen up the fitting, pull it forward, and remove it by means of this hoist. And likewise, replacing, go through the same motions, only in reverse. It wasn't a common...
What about magnetos? Would you have to replace them often, or carburetors?
Very, very rarely. But on occasions... If that was called for, it was a case of removing one, replacing it with another. One of the main problems were your magnetos, which of course you had to tune and time.
Now, how do you do that?
Well, very similar to an ordinary car magneto that was used in those days. You had certain points on the rotor arm which had to be in certain positions. They had to be set very carefully to ensure that the firing was in the right sequence on the cylinders. Otherwise, you had most weird things happening.
So this was it. One thing is, you had a bit of a close escape on a trip with Sergeant Sloman, a Pole.
Oh, yes.
Tell us that, because that sounds quite an interesting story. Was it your first flight?
It was my
very first flight.
My very first flight.
Tell us about that.
In a Wellington. Well, on certain of these flights, where the number of trainee gunners was sometimes lighter than it was on others, on this particular occasion, I think there was only about three young gunners going up, and so I was able to arrange for a flight with this particular pilot. He was a Pole with an English sounding name, but he was a huge bear of a man, and we'd done the gunnery exercise over the North Sea, and when we came back the whole area was fog bound, and we flew around and couldn't find the place, and had to then go inland until we managed to find an airfield that was open where we landed. must admit, I never did know which field that was. But eventually, the station sent a coach to pick us up and brought us back to Manby. My mates on the flight next morning were very concerned because they wondered what in hell's name was going to happen to us. The air control had been firing very light cartridges up into the mist, but of course, obviously, the mist bank was too thick. We never saw them. And my mates used to wonder what the hell had happened to us until I reported back next day.
Let's talk a bit about your mate then. Would this be Alf Chevins?
Yes.
Geoff Cooper and Alf Chevins? Is Alf Chevins a friend?
Yes, Alf was one of my best friends.
What was he like? Give us an idea. Why were you so friendly with this guy?
Just his personality. And we were working together. Alf was one of the fitters, like myself, that worked on these aircraft in the hangar, and we became great buddies. And our flight sergeant in charge of our flight at the time, Duff Cooper, here again, he was another one of these permanent staff, pre-war staff, and like many of the NCOs at the time, they were all old war, pre-war NCOs, and they were really good. And this old boy, Dove Cooper, he would say, if you get a certain job done, Jeff, it's a short weekend pass for you. And on those occasions, invariably Elf got the same time as myself off, we'd go to his home in Grimsby.
Not that far away, then.
Not too far away, no. And his father was the station master at Dock Station. And at that time, he was courting. And his wife and a friend and Elf and I would go dancing in the Gaiety Ballroom at Grimsby. Grimsby had quite a lot of damage done, bombing damage done.
What was it like in it? I mean, it's another world now. What was it like in the Gaiety Ballroom? What was a night out in the Gaiety Ballroom like? What was good about it? What did you do?
Well, in those days, I wasn't much of a dancer, but I soon learned. And we used to thoroughly enjoy it. And then coming home from the...
Who played the music? It wasn't records. I mean, was there a band? Or
a band. Oh, yes, a band. Yeah. Yeah.
And what kind of music were they playing?
Well, most of the tunes of the time. Don't ask me what they were. I can't remember at all now. But we used to thoroughly enjoy it.
And was it a dry affair? You didn't drink anyway, but did
no, it was drink? It was a dry affair. Oh, yes.
And anyway, you saw on the way home from the ballroom...
On the way home from the ballroom, we'd invariably call on a little fish and chip shop, just a matter of about 100 yards from Elf's place. And I must admit, I can still remember the fish and chips we used to get from that place. I've never tasted anything like it since. They were terrific.
Now, there's just a couple more stories. There's one sad, one not so sad. The Hampton that blew up carrying a mine. What do you remember of that?
Yeah. Well, on that particular day, I was servicing my Wellington on the perimeter of the drone when this Hampton took off, and it had just cleared the boundary of the airfield when the whole thing just disintegrated in the air. And I later found out, of course, that it had been carrying an experimental mine.
What was it? I mean, was it a dramatic explosion?
It was.
What could you see?
It was very dramatic. The thing just disintegrated. There was nothing left at all. It just blew up, and a puff of smoke and this terrific explosion.
Noise.
Noise, that's right. and the thing is gone.
And the other one is a story which I don't quite understand, about an auto gyro. What is an auto gyro?
Yes. Well, an auto gyro was the forerunner to the helicopters of today. And that again, that was so funny, because this thing was standing no distance from the point where I was working on a Wellington, and in front of this auto gyro was a Wellington with its engines running. Well, the pilot in this auto gyro started to rev his thing up, when suddenly the Wellington, the engines of the Wellington, were opened up full throttle, and this auto gyro lifted off the ground and turned over and broke up into pieces. And to this day, I can still see the pilot crawling out from this mess. Not hurt. He was a very fortunate man, because the rotors just integrated as soon as it turned over. But there was a lack of procedure there, when you consider that the Wellington should have checked to make sure, and that this auto gyro was fastened or not going to take off as it did.
And another thing is a story about Wellington landing without putting its undercarriage down, doesn't it?
Yes, this is another calamity. The chap was an ex-Fleet Air Arm pilot, had taken this Wellington up on detail with his young trainee gunners. Coming into land, he forgot to put his undercarriage down, and came in and made a perfect belly landing. Fortunately, no one was hurt.
Much damage?
Damaged both air screws, and of course the underside of the aircraft was damaged. But the old Wellington could take a lot of damage. The construction of that was terrific.
So did you get to repair the air screws?
No.
Replace?
No.
That wasn't in your
No, that was literally a write-off.
Now, what about the anti-invasion precautions? This is separate from guard duty. This is actual anti-invasion. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Yes, well, at the time when there was the worry and prospect of invasion, the old Hawker demons were lined up around the perimeter, and I was responsible for starting and running an engine on one of these demons, so that the gunner could operate the turret, which I hate to think what would have happened.
So they'd have been used as
a gun turret. And these would have been manned by the instructors of the air crew.
And what are the precautions? There's some business about Lewis gun and, even rifles and cudgels.
That's right. From my own point of view, I was put in charge of a Lewis gun on one of the points in a dugout on the far perimeter of the airfield. And I hate to think what would have happened had we been invaded. That wasn't the only thing.
Had you been trained in the Lewis gun?
Always, yes.
When had that happened?
I had one or two courses on different guns, the Lewis being one of them. But I think one of the most absurd things were there was a shortage of rifles and guns at the time of the thought of invasion.
This is September 40, I presume.
That's right. We were issued with broomsticks with nails driven through the ends. And I don't think we'd have stood much chance against the Jerry had they have come.
Now, another on the more amusing side, there's the story of WAF knickers being. It's just an amusing story, but you might as well tell it. Though. It's quite funny.
Yeah. Every week we had a colour parade on the square at Manby, and where the whole station had to parade. Now, on one of these parades, when it came to raising the flag, the lanyard flag was placed on the lanyard, and the lanyard was tugged. And what happened was a pair of WAF knickers suddenly fluttered at the top of the flagpole. The lanyard fell down, and of course there was a titter went round the parade to see this. And of course, that didn't amuse us, the commanding officer taking the parade. The commanding officer then brought the parade to attention and called for the perpetrator to come forward. Otherwise, there would be a parade every day of the week, and everyone on the station would have to march round the full perimeter of the airfield, including the WAFs. Well, I was very fortunate. I missed that. I was one of the fortunate ones that I still carried on my normal duties. But I'm not too sure what happened, because after that little episode, the group captain left the station, and we had a new commanding officer who was Wing Commander George Stainforth.
Could you just explain who he was for them?
Now, Wing Commander Stainforth was one of the RAF party that participated in the Snyder Trophy races, and I think it was in 1930 or 31 that he was the RAF officer that broke the airspeed record flying the SB-6, which was a seaplane which was the forerunner of the Spitfire. He was an amazing man. And to be quite honest with you, it was through him that I remastered to aircrew. He used to come on to our gunnery flight, and on several occasions he used to come up to me and say, "Go and get your chute, lad." And up we'd go on flight tests.
You met your parachute?
Yes, my parachute. And on one of these occasions, I shall never forget it as long as I live, that we'd no sooner got up to a reasonable height in this Wimpy, and this particular aircraft had quite a bit of the fabric replaced on the fuselage, and the wing commander started to do aerobatics in this old Wimpy, turning the damn thing inside out, and suddenly all the new fabric that had been put on this aircraft tore away and wrapped itself around the tailplane. Well, I was sitting in what was the wireless operator's seat, and I can't exactly remember what went through my mind at that moment. There was a terrific roar as this fabric tore away, and I just clung on to the framework of where the radio would have been, and to this day I can see the old wing commander looking back, yelling "Are you all right, lad?" Well, I was too petrified to answer. I just sat there, glued to this framework.
Now, how much? Well, I'm not quite sure how much of the fuselage and fabric had gone. All of it, all?
No, about a third. Right down the upper spine of the aircraft.
So two-thirds was left.
Two-thirds were left on the belly, on the underside. But the racket that created with the air suction, drawing everything that was movable out of the geodetic construction of the aircraft, it was frightening. But the worst, of course, was the fact that it wrapped itself around the tailplane.
Now, how did that affect the flying?
Well, fortunately, we'd also taken up the flight sergeant rigger, who had been responsible for the repair of this aircraft. And it took the wing commander and this flight sergeant all their strength to control this aircraft, which he eventually brought into land. And I think everybody on the station was there watching us coming in with this damaged aircraft. And when we got down, he taxied up to the hangar. And when I got out, he came and put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Well, lad, you've had your first bit of experience of what it's like to fly a damaged aircraft. Are you all right?" And I couldn't even answer.
How were you? You must have felt dreadful.
My knees were rather weak. But it was that incident that really persuaded me to remuster to aircraft.
Now that sounds perverse, if you see what I mean, because you come out, your knees are shaking, you're nervous, and you've had a
I think the main inspiration was the way this man handled the whole episode.
So you developed your interest in remustering as a...
I started taking evening classes, and virtually within a week I had to sit aboard on the station in front of this wing commander. And I was one of four out of about 53, I think it was, that were accepted for aircrew on that particular day. I couldn't believe it. And I just continued taking the evening classes there.
So you were accepted in principle, but you stayed on the station?
That's right, yeah.
Now, it was anything else happening? We're starting to edge into... starting to edge into 1941 now. From the looks of things.
That's right.
I don't know. There's no date on that time. It's June 1941 when you applied.
Yeah.
And the selection board was on the 21st of June. I presume that means that incident was near then.
That's right.
So can we just go back a bit? There've been some air raids, some more air raids. 28 small bombs dropped on the drone. What do you remember of German air raids?
Yes, we frequently heard German aircraft passing over the drone, and the one that sticks in my mind more than anything was on one occasion, one German aircraft flew very low, coming over the airfield, flew over the watchtower. Now, on top of this watchtower, there were machine guns. And the machine gun has brought this German aircraft down. And I remember seeing the bodies of these poor chaps. But on the other occasion, we had a whole string...
Did that upset you in the sense of... I mean, you hadn't seen anything like that before, I presume.
As the first dead bodies I'd ever seen. And I suppose it was just the fact that they were dead, irrespective of whether they were German or otherwise. They were only young men.
Now, Anything else about German air raids at the time?
Well, we had, on another occasion, one dropped a string of bombs, which fell on the south side of the airfield, doing very little damage. The nearest one landing in a meadow just beyond the guard room. But they were small bombs, and the hole, the bomb craters, were usually filled in by the young student gunners. And another one of the party used for this was a friend of mine, my barber from Bishop Stortford, that was also stationed at at Manby at the time. He was one of the party filling in these bomb craters.
Now, so this is all going on. Now, what about the courses you were doing? What courses, you know, you were doing courses. You'd been accepted in principle. What courses were you doing?
Basically, maths and English. They were the two prime courses. Maths in particular.
Now,
as you appreciate, I only went to a village school, so my maths only took me so far.
So these they were designed to get you to the point where you would qualify.
Well, I thought it was essential. I had no idea what I was to face on the aircrew courses.
Any other course? You did a machine gun course as well, eh?
Yes. I think the machine gun courses were all part and parcel of the requirement on station duties and protection, of course.
So you're doing those?
Yeah.
Anything else you remember before, you know, other courses?
Not in particular. Not associated with anything other than on station protection.
Now, one thing that's interesting is you get, just before you go, you get sent to take part in a Minister of Information film about the fire.
Oh, yes.
Now, that is interesting because we've probably got that film at the War Museum. Now, can you tell us everything about that you remember?
Yes. Well, just prior to my posting to St. John's Wood, I was given a 48-hour pass to go home and participate in a Ministry of Information film which concerned the history of our family. That was my father and my grandfather, my sister, but primarily because we were all then participating in the prison war. My sister, although not in the land army, was working on the land. My father and grandfather, of course, were still working on the farm, and myself being in the Air Force as a cadet for aircrew. And again, we were interviewed and had a photographic session.
And what do you remember of it? How was the interview and the photo?
I can't remember an awful lot about it, to be quite honest. I think the questions were more questions were put to my father and my grandfather at the time. And I think the saddest thing is that I knew so little of what my father did during the war, and the same thing of my grandfather.
Did you ever see the film?
No. The only thing that I knew associated with it was another friend from the village was in India on his way to Burma, and he saw a magazine with the photographs.
Was it a film or photographs?
Photographs.
So it wasn't an actual film, it was a
photograph? Not a film, I think. It was basically photographs, yeah. In fact, you'll find that in the little book that I wrote myself, there is a photograph showing part of that meeting.
Now, anything else about your time at Manby? Because you finished there in January 1941, Anything else about your time there?
Yeah, one particular thing was that I was best man to Elf when he married his wife. Sadly, he died last year. I've kept in touch with him and his wife right from that time to this.
What was a wartime wedding like? I mean, was it restricted in its celebrations?
Not really. Elf's wife's father was a photographer, so we had a good coverage of photographs of the wedding. And again, there was plenty of food.